Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Free Speech and Election Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, March 25, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. We're pleased to welcome to today's call Mr. Jim Manley. He's a senior attorney at the Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation at the Goldwater Institute. He's going to be talking about this case, giving us some background, letting us know what the status is in opening remarks of about 5 to 10 to 12 minutes. After that, we'll be taking questions from the audience, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. And with that, Mr. Manley, your opening remarks, please.
Thank you, Dean. The case that we're talking about today, we filed at the end of February, and the law we're challenging in Massachusetts allows unions to give $15,000 directly to parties, candidates, and PACs that donate to candidates every year. And businesses, on the other hand, can contribute nothing. Now, union PACs can also give thousands more, up to the ordinary PAC limits, but businesses cannot spend a nickel to form a PAC, run a PAC, or do anything to support a PAC. Even if a PAC uses a business's name, the business has to be compensated for that privilege. So there's no financial support that the business can offer to PACs, whereas the unions are able to provide a tremendous amount of logistical support. And what the Supreme Court has said about these limits on political speech is that the only governmental interest that justifies them is preventing quid pro quo corruption. And so it's absurd to think that unions can contribute $15,000 to a candidate with no threat of corruption, but a single dollar from a corporation would somehow destroy public confidence in democracy. A total ban on business contributions, while their counterparts from the other side of the bargaining table are handing out buckets of money, is unfair and unconstitutional from any perspective. Even when we filed this case, the Common Cause group, a left-leaning group if there ever was one, came out and issued a statement saying that whatever campaign contribution limits apply, and in their preference, the limits would be zero, but whatever limits apply should apply equally to businesses and unions. So it's not hard to see the constitutional problem with a lopsided ban like this. And there are only 8 states that have lopsided laws. The other 42 states and the federal government treat businesses and unions equally. And more than half the states allow businesses and unions to make direct contributions to candidates and parties. There are 6 states that allow unlimited contributions and 20 states that allow equally limited contributions. The other 16 in the federal government prohibit direct contributions. But what most of those states do, and the federal government does, is allow businesses and unions, while they can't make direct contributions, they can spend money to create and administer a PAC. And even that small concession for free speech is unavailable to businesses in Massachusetts. Now, last year, the general court, the legislature in Massachusetts, tried to address the disparity between unions and businesses and do away with this $15,000 limit for unions. And those efforts failed. And so it falls, as it does so often, to the courts to enforce the Constitution. And through this lawsuit, the Goldwater Institute is asking the Massachusetts courts to, at a minimum, follow that majority rule and just simply apply the same campaign finance limitations to unions and businesses. And as I suggested, our claims are brought under both the Massachusetts and federal constitutions in state court. We allege violations of the Equal Protection Clauses and the Free Speech and Association Clauses because it violates equal protection to apply different contribution limits to businesses and unions, and it violates free speech and association rights to set those contribution limits at zero. And those claims, we believe, are strengthened by the recent trend in the Supreme Court, which has been towards increased protection for political speech and increased skepticism of government's excuses for speech restrictions. So, as most of you are aware, in Citizens United, the Supreme Court rejected shareholder protection as a legitimate reason for restricting corporate speech. The court acknowledged that there are other ways that shareholders can be protected if they think that their corporate governance is their corporate governors are using the corporation in an inappropriate way. It's not necessary to restrict political speech in order to protect those dissenting shareholders. And so that concern is off the table. The court has also said three times in recent years that the government cannot stifle speech from some groups in order to benefit other groups. They said that in Davis v. FEC. They said that again in Citizens United, and they said it in McCutcheon just last year, where they also said that the constitutional way to regulate political contributions is through disclosure rather than through limits or much less bans. And importantly for this case, especially in Massachusetts, is that the Supreme Court has never upheld a regulation on corporate political contributions unless businesses were allowed to establish, finance, maintain, and control a PAC. And this goes all the way back to Buckley, where the court acknowledged that even though businesses, corporations, and unions were prohibited from making direct contributions, they could expend unlimited amounts to administer PACs and solicit contributions to those PACs. And so even that small option isn't available in Massachusetts. And so it really puts this case outside of the realm of any other decisions that have come down regarding corporate contribution limits. The plaintiffs that we represent are small family-owned corporations. We're not talking about the big national corporations here. Most corporations are small family-owned businesses like these. We don't envision a huge influx of money into politics in Massachusetts. What we envision here is just allowing unions and businesses to play on a level playing field. That's really all we're seeking with this case. I think that lays out the broad strokes, and if folks have questions about the law, I'd be happy to go into detail or about any other questions regarding the case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to ask a question. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. Let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule of calls while we're waiting to see if anyone rings in today. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be looking at whether the EPA unreasonably refused to consider costs in determining whether it is appropriate to regulate hazardous air pollutants emitted by electric utilities. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And then Friday at 1, we'll be debating the new NLRB representation case rule, so revisiting unions a little bit then. That's Friday at 1. Next week, so far we have telephone conference calls on class action fees and objectors and patent cases in the Supreme Court, and we'll certainly be adding to that list. So please do check the Federal Society's website for updates. Of course, today we're talking with Jim Manley about his lawsuit in Massachusetts. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. While we're waiting to see if we get a question from the audience, Jim, let me ask you, what is the plausible rationale either in the statute or in the defense of the statute in the case for treating the unions differently than the corporations?
Well, as I suggested, the Supreme Court has recognized a couple of distinctions between unions and corporations over the years, shareholder protection being one of the paramount differences the desire to level the political playing field being another. And the court has done away with these rationales for campaign finance laws. And so some of the distinctions are based on those antiquated notions. And those simply no longer apply. They've really never applied in Massachusetts under the state constitution, and they can't support the state under the federal constitution either any longer. If you look back at the genesis of the Massachusetts statute, it's at the turn of the 20th century. And it begins simply by restricting certain corporations from giving to political candidates. Corporations that have essentially only corporations that have public monopolies that are granted by the state. So railroads, telephone companies, corporations of that nature. And so I think that gives you a sense of what the legislature was concerned about. The sort of inappropriate influence that those corporations would have over the folks who are directly responsible for ensuring that their continued existence. And the ban was expanded to include regular, ordinary businesses soon thereafter. But it wasn't until 1988 that these special rules were enacted that allowed unions to contribute as much as $15,000 before they are required to make any disclosures or comply with any other spending limits. And so it's not really the case that we're here in Massachusetts confronting a well-considered statutory scheme. It's been pasted together ad hoc over the course of a century, and it's time, I think, to review where we are and reconsider whether this scheme makes sense in light of the Supreme Court's evolution of campaign finance law and in light of what has transpired in Massachusetts with respect to the regulations and enforcement of the prohibition.
Right. You mentioned the Massachusetts law dates back to the turn of the century, roughly. Is that the case for the other similar laws in other states, or are any of the laws sort of a more recent vintage?
It is. I can't think of any in the other states that are of more recent vintage. They're all in that same era.
And you mentioned that your clients here, the plaintiffs, are sort of smaller businesses. I don't know if that means mom and pop shops, but I assume a win for you would be against the statute in total, and it would apply to the prohibition vis-a-vis the monopoly organizations or the publicly traded corporations. It would totally destroy the statute, I take it.
Well, we're not asking for the court to do anything about that first section of the statute, the first clause that deals with public corporations. We're just talking about ordinary business corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Those folks will have to bring their own lawsuit, I suppose, unless the court issues more sweeping relief than we're really asking for at this point.
Okay. We've got one question on the line now. If you'd like to ask a question and you're in the audience, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Afternoon, Jim. This is Mario Nicholas. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. I was calling because, first of all, I was glad to see you, taking this particular topic up, and it's good to see you really kind of bring it to light. But also I wanted to ask specifically about kind of the detriment that we've had in some of the campaign finance decisions. When it always refers to corporate speech and corporate spending, and I feel like there's, you know, even in Citizens United, it's almost in a footnote that, oh, by the way, this applies to labor unions as well. And certainly, you know, as attorneys, we can parse through that, but it's become such a shorthand in general for the general public to talk about corporate spending, but I think it's almost become detrimental when you then go into to legislative policy and policy gets written and new laws are drafted. I don't know if you can address that at all. I've really taken to talking all about corporate speech and labor union speech, et cetera, as aggregate speech as opposed to individual speech, and thought I'd call and ask for your comments on that.
Well, I think thanks for the question. It's good to hear from someone from Colorado. And as you may know, the Colorado Supreme Court has taken the same view that you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and struck down a prohibition on unions contributing to candidates, whereas certain corporations were allowed to contribute. So I think unions and businesses are opposite sides of the same coin. They sit across from each other at the bargaining table. The whole structure of American labor relations law is premised on the idea that businesses and unions are equally opposed forces. And so I think it only makes sense under the Equal Protection Clause to treat them the same when it comes to contribution limits and other sorts of speech. They, in theory, function the same way. That is the idea on which labor relations law is premised. So I think it only makes sense that would carry through in this context as well.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if we have other questions from our audience, let me ask you how the lawsuit's been received. This, especially, are there any, you know, unexpected supporters of the lawsuit? Any unexpected opposers of the lawsuit?
Well, as I mentioned, the one surprise was Common Cause coming out and at least suggesting that we're on sort of the same page, half the same page, in that we both think that the same limit should apply to businesses and unions. Common Cause takes the view that neither should be allowed to contribute, and we think that raises tremendous First Amendment problems. It's nice to see that some folks are can agree with us, even if they disagree with us on everything else. The state has not responded as of yet. They've asked for an extension on their answer, and so we'll have to see what their reaction is. They haven't commented at all.
All right. We've got another.
Otherwise, the labor unions have also chimed in to say that they obviously support the status quo. It gives them a huge advantage, and so they're interested in protecting that advantage.
Sure. Let's take another question from our audience.
John Rollins, Constitution.org. Is anyone making the argument that there is simply no authority under the Constitution to regulate campaign finance in any way, spending, donations, reporting, anything? I mean, it's not in the Constitution. It's not a necessary implied power of the Commerce Clause. It's not an implied power of the power to regulate time, place, and manner of congressional elections. So, it's just not there. So is anybody arguing that?
So in this case, we're challenging Massachusetts state law. And so we are not making the claim that Massachusetts is without any authority to regulate campaign finance. Really, our only complaint is that the same limits don't apply to both unions and corporations. And frankly, if the state wanted to set the limit lower than the $15,000 limit that they've been operating under since the late 80s, we don't have a problem with that within a certain range. That's not an issue that we're pressing in this case. I think our overall view is that more political speech is better, and I think more contributions to candidates is better as well. It makes the candidates accountable for the speech, and it has always been subject to disclosure when candidates receive contributions. So I think that addresses a lot of the issues that some folks have raised with the aftermath of Citizens United, allowing the more contributions to candidates from more people, from more entities is I think a good thing for participation in democracy and for transparency. So I think because this case involves the state claims and claims against the state law, the issues that you raise about the constitutionality of the federal law are neither here nor there for this case. We do think that this is an issue that the Supreme Court of the United States will have to resolve at some point. They've opened that box with Citizens United, and they'll have to decide how far that decision goes.
So where is the authority in the state constitution?
Well, as I said,
doesn't really cover it. It runs into conflict with incorporation of the Federal Bill of Rights.
Yeah, it's well established that the states have the authority to regulate elections, and there may be some more ambitious claims that could be brought, but we're asking for this modest relief at this point in order to just bring some equality and fairness to the law.
Once again, we're speaking with expert Jim Manley and litigator. If you have a question for him, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few people on the line. We've got some time left. If you've got a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Well, Jim, it seems like we've exhausted the audience questions at this point in time. Let me, before we adjourn the call, give you a chance to wrap up or express any final thoughts you might have. And maybe you can give us some sense of what's expected when in terms of the progress of the case.
Sure. So the as I said, the defendants have asked for an extension on their answer, and we've agreed to that. And so we should have their response toward the end of the month. And then things will move forward from there. Let me touch briefly in a little bit more detail on the scope of this situation. As I mentioned, there are eight states that have lopsided laws: Iowa, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Mississippi, Montana, New Hampshire, and West Virginia are the holdouts that apply these unequal laws. And in six of those states, the corporations are completely banned from giving anything, and unions are allowed to contribute. That's sort of the scope of the problem. We're focused on Massachusetts now, but there are laws in other states that are ripe for challenge, and we're looking at that as well, although our plans are not far enough along that I can comment on it with any more specificity, but this is an issue that we intend to bring to the U.S. Supreme Court and intend to bring in courts across the land to that end.
Well, terrific. I want to thank you so much, Mr. Manley, for joining us today and giving us the sketch of your case here. Wish you good luck going forward. I also want to thank our audience for joining us and for their questions as well. Please be reminded also for our audience, our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at 3 p.m. When we'll be talking about the EPA. But until that next telephone conference call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.